Well, people know me today as the paleo contact guy. And paleo contact is the theory that our ancestors had contact with other civilizations in the deep past. And I mean ET civilizations. And my route into that surprises a lot of people because my background is in Christian ministry. I was for 33 years in church-based ministry. I was an archdeacon in the Anglican Church in Australia, which is one down from a bishop. I was a theological educator, training pastors, in particular in the history of Christian thought and in hermeneutics, which are the principles of interpretation applied to ancient texts, and applying the tools of source analysis, form analysis, linguistic analysis, to all sorts of anomalies in the Bible, anomalies in the stories that we tell from the Bible. But when I followed that white rabbit, got into the translation questions, I discovered that many of the familiar stories that we regard as God's stories turn out to be repeats, summary forms of the Mesopotamian stories of sky people. And I had to start thinking through what are the implications of our God stories being based on somebody else's stories of beings that today we would call extraterrestrials. Before we get into today's content, on behalf of the Fifth Kind TV, I want to say a big thank you to Surfshark for sponsoring today's content. Surfshark is a VPN that allows us all to become citizens of the world through online access. If you're like me, you'll enjoy watching online content from countries all around the world. But I live in Australia, and what I'm shown in internet searches will be different to what you're shown in Canada, America, the Philippines, Germany, the Netherlands, or wherever you're watching from. By using Surfshark, I'm able to access a world of online content and see all the things that you see and many other things beside. Surfshark enables us to become citizens of the world through online availability.
Get fully protected. Go to surfshark.com/fifthkind and get 4 months for free. Surfshark offers a 30-day money-back guarantee, so if you try it and you don't like it, you can easily cancel your subscription and receive a full refund. With Surfshark, you can swim under the radar in the sea of online content.
What reliable information can be gathered about the world from ancient texts like those in the Bible, whose own sources lie shrouded in the mists of prehistory? When we look at stories like Noah's Ark in the Bible, or the fall in Genesis 3, or the two creation accounts in Genesis 1 and 2, or the Tower of Babel in Genesis 11, the obvious question is, what is this? Is this pure fiction? Is it history expressed by an ancient culture, or is it something else? And the answer is really, it's a number of things, because these stories have been retold and retranslated through the ages. And the top layer of the story was written by writers who had a theological message that they wanted to convey through these pre-existing stories. I'll give an example of how we know that. If you go to Genesis 3, which is the story of the snake and Adam and Eve in the garden, you'll find the name Yahweh in that text. But if you follow the story of the Bible, the name Yahweh wasn't even given until after the time of Moses, so in ages and ages later than the action being described. So the fact that you find Yahweh in Genesis 3 tells you that a writer after the time of Moses has gone back and rewritten a pre-existing story, inserting the later name into the story. So the writer is doing that in plain sight. He's saying, now let me tell you this story. And he's doing it with a religious agenda in mind. He wants to present certain ideas of anthropology and theology to the reader. And he's doing that by editing an older text. The older text wasn't interested in those things. And everything I'm saying so far is stuff that every priest and pastor learns in theological college. The original form of that story was the story of Enlil and Enki.
Mysterious accounts found etched into clay tablets in cuneiform script remained a closed window until the 19th century, when the newly discovered translation key, the Behistun inscription, enabled Assyriologists like George Smith, Nathaniel Schmidt, Leonard King, and William Lambert to uncover descriptions of a prehistoric world commemorated in multiple forms by the ancient Mesopotamian cultures of Sumer, Babylonia, Assyria, and Arcadia. Accounts of colonization by advanced non-human visitors included names of certain key players whose activities impinged directly on the development of Homo sapiens. Among them, Enlil and Enki. Their conflict over agendas for humanity is told in the Babylonian Enuma Elish and the Atrahasis tablets. The themes of that conflict echo in the Hebrew story of Adam, Eve, Yahweh, and the serpent in the later biblical narrative of Genesis 3.
Enlil and Enki in the Babylonian story of the Enuma Elish were advanced beings who came and colonized planet Earth and then tinkered with the life on Earth to create Homo sapiens sapiens to be a kind of working class for them. But they conflicted over how intelligent the humans should be, how healthy, how long lived, how many there should be on the planet, and then what measures should be taken to control the population, the size of the population. That's what the conflicts are about in the original version of the story. And then an Elohist writer comes along and he retells that story for a Hebrew audience. And then a Yahwist editor comes along and retells that story again to teach Yahwism. So by the time we're reading the current form, you've got all these different layers. And when we look at these stories, the ones I mentioned, the stories of origins, the stories of the origins of humanity, the stories of the flood, the stories of the Tower of Babel, people today might ask, is that history? And the short answer to that is no, it isn't history, but there may be history in it. There may be memories of real events that really happened that have found their way into these stories. And the reason I take that possibility seriously is that cultures all around the world seem to carry the same memories of certain traumas in the evolution of humanity. And the deluge story is one of them.
The Hebrew Book of Genesis, the Babylonian Epic of Gilgamesh, the 5th century history of Armenia told by Moses Koronatsi, and an ancient Babylonian map now in the British Museum, all point to Turkey and the region of Ararat as the place of humanity's great reboot in the aftermath of an enormous flood.
When I went to Turkey, I was very interested to find that you've got stories that sound very redolent of the Noah story in the aftermath of it. So as I looked into the carvings that were created by the Biennili, this is the Urartian people who lived in that part of the world in modern Turkey and Armenia in the Bronze Age, the stories implied by those symbols are of a time after a cataclysm, when the ecosystem needed rebooting. There's not much story about what the cataclysm was, just we're now in the aftermath of it, how do we get going again? But when you travel south into Iran and further south into Turkey, other stories emerge to do with cataclysm that are not flood stories. They are the stories of some other disaster, a great and terrible winter. And in order to survive that, the people living there had to go underground and live in underground cities, which we can still explore to this day. So we've got those stories, great and terrible winter, and flood narratives, and the post-apocalypse stories of the Urartu people. So in my book, The Eden Enigma, I consider how all those stories go together, how they're related, whether they might refer to something real, something historical, how they might relate, and what the message was that our ancestors wanted us to pick up from their cultural memories of those cataclysms.
How do these ancient memories of prehistoric cataclysms relate to the idea of paleocontact?
The evidence was so compelling when I began looking at the correlations among the ancients' stories of origins. And so many of them begin with the arrival of advanced beings from the sky, or what we would call from space. So in the Bible, you've got the arrival in the sky of the Ruach with the Elohim in it, the powerful ones. Mayans in the Popol Vuh talked about the feathered serpents arriving in the skies and hovering over the flood waters of a devastated planet. Same picture as in Genesis 1. In the Enuma Elish, it's when in the heights, and we've got the descent of the gods, the Anunnaki, from the heights, who come and rehabilitate a devastated planet. They begin with the separation of waters, salt water from fresh water, in the same way that we see in other ancestral narratives. Go to the Philippines, Tagalog arrives, the hawk, and does the terraforming over a flooded world and clears the water to create the islands. There's similar story told by the Iroquois people. There's similar story told by the Efik people in Nigeria, of the descent of the gods from the sky on a chain. You have to ask, why would so many diverse cultures want to credit the recovery of a devastated planet to advanced others coming from the sky? Why would you invent that? It doesn't glorify your ancestors or your elders. And why are the visual overlaps so strong? The process begins with people hovering in the sky, and then the clearing of waters and the separating of waters, and then the recovery of botanical life, and then an alteration of the survivors, the animal and proto-human survivors. It was those correlations that made me go back to the Mesopotamian stories and the biblical stories that emerged from them and read them with a more open eye and asking the question, what memory is at the core of this? And it seems to be a visual memory, because so many of the overlaps are of things that were seen, and the different cultures have found their own language and metaphor to report essentially the same thing that was seen. So that's what got me into this pathway, and it then forced me to think through the implications for how I understand God, how I understand humanity, how that reframes my faith. And it's taken me a long time really to process all that, but I've shared the journey as I've gone. So every book in the Eden series tracks that journey as I gather more data, apply more logic to what we found, and do that little bit more work in reframing my faith and my worldview.
Is it possible that the intelligent observation and curation of planet Earth extends far further back than the timeline of Homo sapiens? And if it does, how could we possibly know?
A couple of references suggest our knowledge of the planet extends far beyond anything we know about the emergence of Homo sapiens. The Book of Job describes the water jets at the bottom of the oceans that are generating water for the oceans. We didn't know anything about those jets or the sub-ocean ocean until very recently. But there's a knowledge of it in the Book of Job, and it's just stated very matter-of-factly and very confidently. Some readers might say, well, that might be pure coincidence, because there's plenty in the Bible that is taken as metaphor and has never proven to be anything scientific. Maybe randomly they got this thing right. But it's such an odd thing to imagine that does turn out to be accurate. It makes me wonder if the writers of Job, which some scholars believe may be the earliest piece of literature that found its way into the Hebrew canon, if the writers had this information from a prior advanced culture, a previous civilization, or visitors from elsewhere who understood our planet's history. How else could they have known that? And it's one of a couple of references that suggests our knowledge of the planet extends far beyond anything we know about the emergence of Homo sapiens. in Genesis 9, 10, and 11, there is a very brief mention that strongly suggests Pangaea, when all the continents were joined up, one landmass, one coastline around it. It's mentioned very quickly. It's easy to miss. It's often translated in a way that sort of hides it. But I lean to that interpretation of the beginning of Genesis 11. And I have to ask, how could human beings know anything about a time when the continents were joined up unless they were told by others of another civilization, a longer-lived ET culture who knew the longer history of the planet? There's no way a writer could have successfully dreamt that up. So there are these little hints, fragments of a longer story that have survived through the ages and all their way into the current form of the Hebrew scriptures and other ancestral narratives around the world.
How could Homo sapiens and modern human culture forget so many aspects of its deep past?
In my book, Echoes of Eden, I talk about a deliberate process of suppression of ancient knowledge. But there's another side to the story too, where ancient cultures had a taboo around what happened before the cataclysm. So when I was in Turkey, I was very interested to see that the story began in the recovery time. Same as in Genesis 1. Genesis 1 is the beginning of a recovery. Same as in the Popol Vuh. It begins the story of the recovery of a devastated planet. Same with the Filipino story. So what happened before? How did the planet get flooded? Why was it, in the Hebrew words, tohu wa bohu, devastated and ruined? What had gone wrong? And you can find cultures all around the world, from the Urartians in Turkey and Armenia to Aboriginal Australians, whose stories acknowledge a cataclysm before, but they won't talk about it, or at least they won't talk about it in detail, maybe because it was too traumatizing. And so the stories of origins all begin after that thing that happened that we don't speak of. And I find that very, very intriguing.
Of course, cultural taboos surrounding the open discussion of what went before persist to this day.
In Egypt, it's interesting that we can go and visit the pyramids, the Valley of the Kings, find all these fascinating artifacts. I remember going there many years ago with my dad, and we were looking through the Museum of Cairo at all these phenomenal artifacts from the dynastic period. And then we'd come across something that looked really, really advanced. And I'd ask the guide, where's this from? Ah, this is the pre-dynastic period. The pre-dynastic period. So what was happening then? Oh, that was just a period of sort of very basic farming life. Nothing much was happening in Egypt at that time. Really? And they produced this? So there's this huge gap in our knowledge of how come the older stuff is more advanced. Who really produced that? And why is there a decline in technological ability from the pre-dynastic to the dynastic? That doesn't make any sense. And now, of course, we realize there are some serious questions to be asked about the dating of the Sphinx, the pyramids, the artifacts of ancient Egypt that suggest a far longer timeline than you or I would have learned in school. And in Turkey, the interesting thing is that we've got Karacadağ, a site that it is argued is the earliest known farm, the beginning of civilization, because of course civilization depends on agriculture. And in 1998, a team went into Karacadağ in southeast Turkey, headed up by Manfred Hoyne of the University of Norway in Aarhus, along with teamsters from the Max Planck Institute in Cologne, Germany. And they identified this place where, from out of the blue, 11 naturally occurring plants were modified to become cultivatable crops. And in the same place, at the same time, the tribal family who did this miraculously invented animal husbandry. But here's where the plot thickens, because travel a few hours down the road and you are at Göbekli Tepe, which appears to have been buried at the same time that Karajadar was emerging. It is a huge megalithic site that suggests a megalithic culture and therefore suggests a prior civilization, a prior culture to the creation of civilization as we know it. And so when you see that, you have to ask, well, might there have been some information that flowed from a previous culture to a new one? Might the tutors that our ancestors spoke about have been the survivors of the cultures that were here before the great and terrible winter and the flood and fire events of the Younger Dryas period? And I think that may be part of the story, except there is another layer to it. Because if we look at the cultures that lived in what is now Turkey and Armenia, they related their visitors to particular regions of space. Their stories were not of beings descending on a chain or landing in their craft, but of appearing through bright doorways. So they had narratives about these bright doorways. In other words, doors that open and they can't understand where all the light is coming from behind the door, which strongly suggests artificial lighting. Every time these advanced beings turned up in their craft, when they opened the door, there was bright light shining through that doorway and they walked out of that light. And when they left, they walked back into it. And I find correlations between the Urartian story, an ancient story in Iceland and Sweden that relates to these bright doorways as well. But when we get onto the symbols that they left behind and the art that they left behind, then we've got that other aspect that we mentioned before of beings turning up in the sky. Because in the capital city of modern Armenia, at Yerevan, in the Fortress of Blood created to celebrate the Urartian culture in the Bronze Age, the biggest work of art that has survived is a blue sky filled with flying discs. And it seems to me that is also telling the story of the beginning of the recovery, the arrival of the flying discs in the sky, the arrival of the Tingir, the advanced beings through the bright doorways. And then what follows is a story of help and tuition and collaboration to reboot humanity in a post-apocalyptic world. And those are the stories the Urartians carry in their art. The Urartian story is of advanced beings arriving after a cataclysm to help us recover. And what's interesting about that is it shows that these advanced beings had finite powers. They were unable to prevent the chaos of the Younger Dryas cold period, but they were able to support humanity in its reemergence after the cataclysm. So that in itself is very, very interesting. It scales these beings down from being gods, which is how we've often told other cultures' stories. We've used that word and suddenly we've sort of mythologized it. The word god really carries all the wrong associations. You say the word god and you think of a supernatural, transcendent, probably imagined being, whereas the Tingir were finite beings similar to us, but with better technology, who lived here for a while. It's a very finite story. As to how much help we've had technologically, it's a great question. One of the mysteries of ancient Egypt, one of the mysteries of the Andean civilizations is who built what was here before? Firstly, you do identify a before and after of technological ability, and you go further back and you find something more advanced that the locals say, we actually don't know who built this. This was here when we arrived. And we find a technology for the manipulation of stone and the finessing of stone that we can't quite get our heads around. Now, that might just be the artifact of a very advanced human culture that we don't know anything about. That's entirely possible. Humans are very, very clever. But our ancestral stories do talk about help in every department. So the Babylonians say that the ancestors of the Sumerians learned their ability to work with stone, whether that's megalithic building, canalization, from non-human others. The Babylonians have the story of Oannes and the Apkallu, who arrived from somewhere else. They're non-humans. first contact terrified the humans, who perceived them as terrible monsters, to use his word, and then found out that they were friendly and were going to help them. And they taught them civil engineering, how to canalize the environment and make it fertile, how to do agriculture, and then how to read and write and do maths and create money systems and banking systems and legal systems and record keeping, all the accoutrements, says the Babylonian priest Berossus, all the accoutrements of civilization. And that's just one example of ancient cultures giving credit to non-human others for the technological abilities of their ancestors. And you can hear that theme repeat in cultures around the world. It's there in Hebrew story, giving credit to beings like Asherah. It's in the Mesopotamian story, in the Babylonian story, giving credit to Asherah, strangely familiar sounding name. Mbabwana Warisa is credited in Zulu story, and so it repeats. Prometheus, of course, in the Greek story. This giving of technology, this helping and support of humanity, is a universal story the world over.
What forgotten technologies have been hidden in plain sight, portrayed by ancient artists, yet unrecognized by a modern audience? What is the meaning of ancient flying discs, prehistoric wristwatches, or the famous pine cone and handbag of the gods?